And good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is Marie versus State of Nebraska. Mr. Friedman, good morning to you.
May it please the court. In 2015, Justice Scalia quoted Mr. Justice Sutherland's words from 1925. The plain, obvious, and rational meaning of a statute is always to be preferred to any curious, narrow, hidden sense that nothing but the exigency of a hard case and the ingenuity and study of an acute and powerful intellect would discover. This court echoed that proposition of law in Lombardo just last year by stating, quote, "We are not at liberty to add language to the plain terms of a statute to restrict its meaning." Further, in Hess versus State, a case about the Nebraska Claim for Wrongful Conviction and Imprisonment Act, this court stated, quote, "Absent anything to the contrary, an appellate court will give statutory language its plain and ordinary meaning. When construing a statute, an appellate court must look to the statute's purpose and give the statute a reasonable construction that best achieves that purpose rather than a construction that would defeat it." The judgment of the district court ignores the plain, unambiguous meaning of the Wrongful Conviction Act by categorically denying relief under the act to the people who have been pardoned. The state's position does just what this court stated in Hess that this court could not do, which in Hess the court stated that a court must attempt to give effect to all parts of the statute, and if it can be avoided, no word, clause, or sentence will be rejected as superfluous. As Professor Schwartz and Amicus note, there's simply no canon of statutory construction which supports the statutory interpretation adopted by the district court.
Was the district court's result based on statutory interpretation, or was it based on the concept of res judicata?
Well, I think they go hand in hand, Justice Papik. I mean, the district court found that the appellant's contention of legal innocence, her pardon, essentially prevented her, because of res judicata, from even proving her actual innocence by clear and convincing evidence. So the district court adopted an interpretation of the statute which allowed for the application of res judicata in clear contravention of the plain language of the statute, the structure of the statute, the purpose of the statute, and the clear implication that the legislature abrogated res judicata in this class of cases.
What's the argument for why the legislature abrogated res judicata under this statute?
Because the legislature said that people who are pardoned have the door open to them to prove actual innocence. So it doesn't make any sense to say that people who are pardoned are then prevented categorically from proving their actual innocence because of the underlying conviction that they're there to prove was unfair, such that they are entitled to compensation. It reads out compensation for anybody who's pardoned.
Does the nature of the pardon have any impact on our analysis?
I don't think so, Justice Stacey. The statute just says if you're pardoned, that opens the door. That's enough under the second prong of the act to move on, to prove your actual innocence. There's nothing in the act which says this kind of pardon is okay, that kind of pardon isn't okay. So I don't think there's any distinction at all, nor should this court.
What is the effect, what's the meaning of a pardon vis-a-vis innocence?
Well, the meaning, the pardon does not prove the innocence. That's why the legislature said that you have to prove your innocence by clear and convincing evidence. In the same way that in Hess, the fact that the conviction was vacated did not automatically prove actual innocence. This court stated in Hess that just because the conviction had been vacated, the plaintiff could not rest on the common law notion of presumption of innocence, but had to make an affirmative showing of actual innocence. Yes.
So pardon gives a ticket to ride, is that?
Yes, Justice, the Chief Justice. The pardon is a condition precedent to applicability of the act, to going before the bench and proving your actual innocence in order to get compensation.
Outside of the context of this statute, what did the pardon give your client? What's the legal effect of the pardon outside of this statute?
Well, I think the legal effect of the pardon is to be able to go out to society and say, I've been essentially forgiven, and the state has recognized that I'm entitled to the pardon, and there's certain societal benefits to the pardon.
But you don't equate forgiven with innocence.
Correct, and our position is not at all in the slightest that just because there's a pardon, somehow have proven actual innocence. The district judge said that we don't even get to move on and prove actual innocence because the conviction still stands. And mind you, the underlying conviction is rife with proof that Ms. Marie was innocent of these charges. The court in the Oldenburg case and the underlying criminal action on appeal noted in plain language there were plenty of facts to suggest self-defense. The crime
well, isn't the problem here that we're all grappling with is what does actual innocence mean in this statute?
Well, the court has said that actual innocence means the absence of facts underlying the actual sentence of the crime or the conviction of the crime. And that's what we have here, Mr. Chief Justice. We have an absence of facts.
Does it actually mean I wasn't the person who did this? I didn't commit this action?
I don't think that's what it means, Mr. Chief Justice. Actual innocence means that there is an absence of facts used to prove the crime. And
were those facts available at the time of the trial, the original trial? What's changed from the original conviction and now?
Well, first of all, the pardon. Second of all, the statute being in place to seek conviction for wrongful compensation, wrongful conviction. And more importantly, Justice Funke, is that the underlying conviction really only matters, and the court should only look at that underlying conviction if the court is persuaded that res judicata ought to apply. And there's really no statutory construction that allows res judicata to apply in these circumstances. And the state has admitted as such in its application of the act previously, in the Daryl Parker case, in the Beatrice Six case. All those folks were pardoned, and they were paid by the state. So there's really no reason to look at the underlying conviction, but the underlying conviction itself is flawed because of the bad jury instructions. And this court, in the Oldenburg case, acknowledged that essentially Ms. Marie was acting in self-defense. The court said in that case that there was evidence that Kurt physically abused Charlene and that it was undisputed. The evidence was that she was in a rural area with an intoxicated and angry person with a history of physical abuse who only moments earlier had abused her. Quote, these facts are not in dispute. There's really no doubt that Charlene Marie was acting in self-defense, and the pleadings, our pleadings in this case, adequately pled that, and the Oldenburg case enumerates all those facts as well.
Is actual innocence a term of art?
I think so, but it's been defined in such a way, Justice Papik, by this court that supports our analysis, because there were an absence of facts to prove the terroristic conviction. Conviction. Terroristic threat is a person commits it when they threaten to commit any crime of violence with the intent to terrorize another. The record and the pleadings in the wrongful conviction case and in the underlying case proved there was zero intent to terrorize another. There was only intent to defend.
So if we set aside your contention about the error in the jury instructions, are you essentially, if you're allowed to proceed, are you essentially going to argue to the district court that the jury got it wrong?
Justice Papik, the jury's determination in the underlying case does not become evidence.
I don't know that this cuts one way or the other. I just wanted a yes or no answer to that question.
I think yes, they did get it wrong, in part because they were instructed poorly, but that does not become part of the record in the subsequent case, in the wrongful conviction case. I'll reserve my time if there are no other questions. That's a little extra bit. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Rowley, good morning to you.
Chief Justice. May it please the court. The purpose of the Wrongful Conviction Act is to allow individuals who have been in prison for crimes that they did not commit to seek relief from the state. And in order to be entitled to that relief, you have to establish two things. One of those things is legal innocence, and the other is actual innocence. Those are two completely separate concepts. Legal innocence would constitute a pardon. The statute itself allows a pardon to constitute legal innocence. Actual innocence has to be the absence of facts that are prerequisites for the sentence given. And before I get too far into my argument, I do want to point out a case that's not in my brief, but found in subsequent research. And that case actually says that res judicata does preclude relief under a wrongful conviction act where the conviction is still intact. And that case is State versus Trapp, T-R-A-P-P, and the site is 34 Ohio Miscellaneous 2nd. Going back to my argument, Marie in this case hasn't pled.
Just before you go on, is that a Supreme Court of Ohio decision or is that a lower court decision?
It is a court of common, a lower court decision.
Okay.
But actual innocence, as we know from Hess, is the absence of facts that are, or yes, the absence of facts that are prerequisites for the sentence giving. But also we know from the Nadim case that you can't just plead a lack of intent, which is what Marie did in this case.
Counsel, can I back you up a little bit and ask you to describe or explain for me what is the primary purpose served by the doctrine of res judicata? And is the application of that doctrine something that is consistent with the act we're talking about?
Justice Stacey, the primary purpose of res judicata is to prevent someone from having a second bite at the apple, so to speak. Once the judgment
is that consistent with the Wrongful Conviction Imprisonment Act, or is that the second bite?
It is consistent with the act. And the reason that it's not the second bite is, and I think of this as something similar to a writ of error quorum nobis. You have to have some new factual evidence, which is why res judicata wouldn't be a bar if Marie had that in this case. You have to have new evidence that either that A wasn't available at the time of judgment, that B was undiscoverable and can't be an error of law that would make her actually innocent in this case.
But the wrongful conviction statute doesn't talk at all about newly discovered evidence, does it?
It does not, but it...
And that's something the legislature knows how to put in its statutes, correct? The concept of relief being available if evidence is newly discovered?
Correct, but notably, Justice, the legislature also didn't say that res judicata doesn't apply in this case. You can't come again and make the same arguments that you made in your original criminal case, especially when your conviction still stands. Remember, a pardon only eliminates the sentence. It doesn't eliminate the actual conviction. Marie's conviction is still intact. That's why res judicata applies to bar her in this case.
How do you know that there aren't additional facts that she wishes to, or new facts or new evidence that she wishes to raise at a trial?
There aren't any in the amended complaint. The amended complaint, she essentially says, she discusses the issues that she had with her husband in the past with domestic violence, and then she says, I was in possession of a gun, I pointed that gun at my then husband, I said something along the lines of, don't come any closer, don't take another step, the gun discharged and he was injured. That's sufficient to satisfy a terroristic threat and use of a weapon to commit a felony.
If there were allegations in the motion or the complaint that were new, would your position be that res judicata wouldn't apply?
It depends on what those new facts are. And that's why I think the writ of error quorum nobis works in this case. It has to be something that wasn't...
You're saying quorum nobis just by way of analogy.
Correct.
But doesn't a quorum nobis, isn't it grounded on the fact that there was something fundamentally wrong with the prosecution from the get-go? You charged me as John Doe, but in fact, I'm Mary Doe.
Exactly.
I was never John Doe.
Exactly.
Okay,
and
that's a fundamental error. That's not a question of proof.
Well, it's a factual issue, and that's what we need to focus on here. It's not a legal issue, and legal errors wouldn't be appropriate in this case. It has to be, just like you said, the circumstance where Marie was not the person who shot her husband.
So this isn't a quorum nobis. That's why I'm having trouble applying your analogy.
But actual innocence, even as it's defined in Hess, it's an absence of facts. So in the Wrongful Conviction Act, when you look at the purpose of it, it's for someone who did not commit the crime, which means you weren't there, someone else did it, like the Beatrice Six case, DNA evidence said that you didn't do it. It has to be that strong of evidence. And
but Ms. Olden, or Ms. Marie is contesting that she didn't commit the crime. She's saying these things that happened don't amount to a crime. Why doesn't that allow her to proceed?
Because that's illegal. That's illegal innocence. It's not actual innocence. It's the same defense in saying that the jury instruction was wrong. That's a legal argument. It's not actual facts that make her innocent of the crime.
Wouldn't even actual innocence absorb legal innocence?
Say that again, Joseph.
Wouldn't actual innocence absorb, think of a Venn diagram, actual innocence, wouldn't that absorb legal innocence?
No.
Why not?
It's the state's position that they're completely separate concepts. Actual innocence has to be based on facts. Legal innocence is based on a legal argument that you did ineffective assistance of counsel or the jury instructions. That's something completely separate. And quite frankly, the pardon already gets her over that hurdle, so we don't need to make those arguments at this stage of the case anyway. It has to be that strong of a situation where you weren't there, it wasn't you, the person isn't dead that we suspected.
So does she have to plead in this case that she was not the person who committed this act?
Not necessarily in this case, but it has to be evidence that it's that strong. I mean,
well, we didn't get that far. We don't really know the details of her claim that could amount to actual innocence.
To survive a motion to dismiss, you have to plead enough to show that you have a plausible claim, which means she has to plead the absence of facts, and we simply don't have that.
She's pretty much pled what the statute outlines, has she not?
What makes it definitive that it's not plausible?
She hasn't pled an absence of.
It's just a language barrier? Is that all this event is?
No, Justice. She pled that she was in possession of the gun, pointed it at her husband, and made threatening statements. That's sufficient to be charged with terroristic threats and use of a firearm in doing so.
Sufficient to be charged?
Correct.
Is it sufficient to be convicted?
Say that again.
Is it sufficient to be convicted?
Absolutely. The jury convicted her on the same evidence that she's now arguing.
So all of the facts that she would seek to prove must be pled? Is that where we're going? Let's say she said, I had the gun, he's done these things and so forth, but she fails to prove I shot him. But as it turns out, I'm missing two hands, not in the record.
Meaning she was unable to actually shoot the gun?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would be a change in circumstances, but to the extent that she was missing two hands, it would have been something that the court knew about at the time of her original trial, meaning she would have had the opportunity to make those arguments.
So it's the failure to take advantage of the opportunity at the original case that dooms this?
It's hard to answer that question on the facts, because there's no way a jury would have convicted her if she didn't have hands to begin.
Should she be given an opportunity to replead?
Replead in this case?
Yeah.
She didn't ask for an opportunity. We're here on an amended complaint. She's already repled at least once, and she didn't ask the district court to replead.
The trial court's order said that that there was an express finding that the defect couldn't be remedied, and so there wasn't going to be leave granted to amend. Was that wrong?
I don't think so. Unless Marie has facts that aren't present here, and quite frankly, she still could have asked the court to move. She could have asked for leave to amend and say, Judge, I have new facts that I'd like to present in my complaint. That didn't happen here. There aren't any facts in that amended complaint that allege actual innocence.
In your brief, you cite State versus Spady, and you quote from Spady language that says that a pardon exempts an individual on whom it is bestowed from the punishment that the law inflicts. Spady goes on to say, speaking about a pardon, it's a declaration on record by the chief magistrate of a state or county that a person named is relieved from the legal consequences of a specific crime. Pardon is also defined as the act or an instance of officially nullifying punishment or other legal consequences of a crime. But when it's talking about when we've said it nullifies other legal consequences, why wouldn't the future application of res judicata be a legal consequence that would be nullified by a pardon?
And Justice, I am out of time. Do I have permission to answer you?
It's up to the chief.
You may.
And I want to make sure that I'm understanding your question. The pardon only eliminates the sentence itself. It doesn't eliminate the actual conviction. So.
Well, I'm reading from Spady, and Spady talks about relieving from the legal consequences. So why isn't the application of res judicata a legal consequence that's nullified by a pardon?
Because there's no indication that that's actually the case. The legal consequence that's the only relief when you're pardoned is just from the sentence itself. Spady doesn't say that your conviction has been overturned and reversed. It's still intact. We still have a jury verdict. And unless Marie can establish some new facts or some different information than what's actually been pled in the amended complaint here, that is actually an absence of facts, then she can't proceed to survive a motion to dismiss.
Would the Spady language be directed at collateral consequences or license revocations, things like that, that might otherwise follow from the conviction?
Yes, Justice, that would be a good example of something as well. And I see that I am out of time. If there are no further questions, the state would ask you to affirm the decision of the judge.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 38 seconds, Mr. Friedman.
There's been no argument by the state that disproves the central thesis of the appellant's position, which is that the state's position guts the statute, inviting this court to rewrite what the legislature did in an obvious act of judicial activism. There's simply no good reason to insert terms into the statute to distinguish between types of pardons or to require some new finding of new evidence. That there was no new evidence in the Daryl Parker case and the state paid Mr. Parker. We don't need to show new evidence. All we need to show is a pardon, and then we get to prove actual innocence. And that's what Charlene Marie intends to do, and that's what the Oldenburg court recognized when they noted that Ms. Marie was basically innocent because of self-defense. Thank you.
Thank you very much.